Okay, it is about 9 minutes after 3 and March 8th. And before we start, I'd like to encourage anyone out there that has a cell phone to please shut it off. And staff, if you're going to open up candy or cough at the table, if you're going to open up candy, put it under the table so it doesn't make all this noise. And if you're going to cough, push your button so that it covers up the sound over someone who's talking. Otherwise, it's hard for the people that do the transcribing to hear all the words.
Just, Madam Chair, just to let you know, I made the request in Judiciary. We just got these microphones to have the default be off and to then have an individual push when they want to speak. They're accommodating that request for me, so might be interested in that for your committee, too.
I think they should automatically do it in every committee room, but anyway, that would be great.
But, Madam Chair, breathing is okay?
Well...
Don't be for you.
Okay. Let the record show that Representative Seaton, McGuire, Anderson, Gardner, and Cisna and myself are here, and that Corrine has been excused for travel. And also, committee staff here, we have our secretary, Nikki Hughes, and our LIO staff person is Doug Learman, and my committee HES aide is Kathy Hope Erickson. So on our agenda today, we are going to have 3 bills, and we'll kind of see how they progress through the committee and what happens. House bill, and I'm going to do them in this order for the people that are online so they kind of know how to plan. House Bill 151 first, then House Bill 16, and then House Bill 20. We will have public testimony on all 3 bills. And so for the committee members, behind tab 1 is our House Bill 151. Responsibility for eye care after surgery, and Representative Tom Anderson is going to present the bill, and Representative Anderson, I'll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, and I think I'll have my staff, John Bittner, come up and present just the basic dynamics of the legislation that I'm proposing. But I want to preface this by saying I've met with the optometrists and their advocate, and in fact we spoke before the committee, and I want them to know that I want this legislation to work for all, and I lean my ear to the ophthalmologist, as I did in legislation in the last legislature, for medical doctors and others in terms of fairness and competition. The optometrists have said and will testify that maybe this does the converse of that. I'm not sure if that's accurate. We're the public policymakers, so we can listen to the debate. But I have friends that are optometrists, too, and you find yourself in a tenuous position. And those of you like yourself and Representative McGuire who serve longer, where you face both, and you think, okay, one feels like I'm slighting their industry or their profession for the other or their specialty, and I don't want them to feel that way. And I think the debate will ensue through your guidance. And, I did sponsor the bill, so I'm not against it, obviously, but conversely, I want to hear all the facts. And at this stage, I agree with the ophthalmologist, but I talked with optometrists the other day and certainly look forward to their testimony as well if they can generate any new information.
All right. John?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. My name is, for the record, my name is John Bittner. I'm staff to Representative Anderson. House Bill 151 outlines rules and restrictions regarding the delegation of postoperative care for eye surgery patients. The provisions include in Section 1, placing limits on how and when a surgeon who performs eye surgery in this state may delegate responsibility to someone else for postoperative care of the patient. Some of these restrictions include defining the provisions of the co-management agreement, mandating that a surgeon who performs a surgery must remain physically available to the patient for 120 hours, allowing the doctor to delegate the responsibility for aftercare if they arrange for another ophthalmologist to care for the patient for those 120 hours. It also outlines when a co-management agreement for postoperative care may be entered into, maintains that any fees incurred as a result of the agreement must reflect fair market value, and includes provisions for the disclosure of the co-management agreement to the patient. Sections 2 through 3 require compliance with Section 1 of the bill. They're basically there for consistency in the statutes. Section 4 adds the definition of knowingly, which is a term used in Sections 1 and 3 of the bill. And Sections 5 and 7 amend the uncodified law of the state of Alaska to add an effective date. This section allows the state medical board to begin the regulations process before the rest of the bill takes effect, just for these sections. Section 6 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, allowing the application of the amendments made by the bill to eye surgery occurring on or after the effective date of Sections 1 through 4 of the bill. The intent of this bill is to provide standards of care regarding co-management agreements for postoperative care of eye surgery patients. The sponsor feels that there is a certain minimum standard of care each and every Alaskan should expect after receiving eye surgery. HB 151 ensures that they receive this that care. I would like to make it clear that this bill in no way reflects poorly on the co-management system. We are not against the collaboration of ophthalmologists and optometrists when it is in the best interest of the patient. All we're trying to achieve here is to set certain limits to the co-management system to ensure that the patient's needs come first. Thank you for listening to my testimony. If you have any questions, I will do my best to answer them for you.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, does the state medical board have the ability to regulate post-operative care currently for any operations?
And I'm going to interrupt through the chair.
Representative Anderson.
The ophthalmologist that's here, the doctor that wanted to testify, might be better able to answer some of the technical questions on the way the medical board goes, because I don't think I've had John research that far. So maybe we can have him come up and testify, and then your questions as to performance and surgery and the current system and statistics and how many optometrists and ophthalmologists, things that the committee may want to ask. Is it okay if he comes up next?
Yeah, that we could do that. And also we have Michael Levitt online, who is with the American Academy of Ophthalmology. He might be able to answer some things,
exactly,
too. So if
Representative, and that's fine. I just want to make sure that this is a more general question as to the regulatory ability of the state medical board. And if you don't have the answer, that's fine. We can, you know, we can get it later, or we can ask the optometrist or the ophthalmologist to address that as they come up. But I would like to find that.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I have a question for the sponsor or his delegate. Are there other surgical procedures for which the state mandates that the surgeon must be available for a specified time afterwards?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I am not aware of any at this point. It doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't any, but I can find out that answer for you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Looks like that's about all the questions that we have right now. I've got a couple questions, but I kind of want to wait until I hear some more testimony before I ask that question. So we can, what I'll do is I'll hear testimony from people that are online, and we'll start with Carl Rosen. Are you online, Carl?
Yeah, hi, I'm online.
Okay, go ahead and state your name and your affiliation.
Sure, Carl Rosen. I'm an MD. I'm with the I'm the president of Alaska Academy of Ophthalmology. I can answer Representative Seaton's question as well as Representative Gardner's question. The medical board does have that jurisdiction, although it has not come up, but it certainly can come up if necessary. Representative Gardner, have other surgeries required this? The lion's share of co-management occurs between ophthalmology and optometry. It is rare for other specialties to do this. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but the lion's share occurs between ophthalmology and optometry. Thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of this extraordinary bill. It truly is a privilege. My name is Carl Rosen. I'm an MD. I'm an orbital and oculoplastic surgeon and neuro-ophthalmologist through fellowship training. I've been practicing in Anchorage for 11 years at Ophthalmic Associates, which is the largest ophthalmology practice in the state of Alaska. I'm the president of the Alaska Academy of Ophthalmology, and I speak on behalf of the ophthalmology members of the state of Alaska. We are in favor of this bill for the protection of our patients and to avoid the abuses that have arisen from co-management that was originally started with good intentions but has become distorted based on financial incentives. Let's join together to raise the standard of medical care for Alaskans. Let's keep the bar high or elevated. Your constituents expect this, as do our patients. Optometry would have you believe that ophthalmologists are nothing more than surgical technicians only capable of wielding a scalpel or a laser. There is nothing farther from the truth. We represent the best the American medical system has to offer, and it is our obligation reflected in the Hippocratic Oath when we enter into a doctor-patient relationship, especially the sacred arena of surgical care, to follow our patients ourselves and not designate care for our patients, particularly to one whom has never touched a scalpel or laser or had any other surgical training. Excuse me. There will be rare times when co-management is necessary and legitimate in rural areas with no other ophthalmologist or surgeon available, or when the surgeon has no other choice but to leave shortly after an operation. However, we are asking to shut the door on the routine use of this arrangement, which unfortunately occurs here in our state. Patients simply do not understand what they're getting into until it is too late. Let me provide an example. 9 months ago, I was on call for Alaska Regional Hospital, and a patient operated on by a surgeon who routinely has an optometrist follow his post-ops was in the emergency room for a corneal surgical complication. The optometrist was nowhere to be found, which is usual and typical, since optometrists do not and have never taken call for hospitals or emergency rooms at Providence or Alaska Regional here in Anchorage. And the emergency room physician is not going to track that optometrist down or refer to an optometrist for liability issues. So consequently, it became my responsibility. Additionally, testimony, let me read testimony from Gary Jackson to the Hess Committee back in April 1st of 2003, supporting House Bill 142. Just to paraphrase, she underwent surgery upon the recommendation of her optometrist, never met her surgeon before surgery or after surgery, went straight back to the optometrist, developed a complication, and went untreated for 2 weeks. She then was transferred to care at our clinic, where our surgeon met with the patient before, during, and after subsequent surgery, called the patient the same night, and was available at all times during the postoperative period. In summary, co-management can be a legitimate and useful tool for patients in rare circumstances, but should never be employed on a routine basis whereby the optometrist expects to be paid for every patient that gets referred to a particular ophthalmologist. This was never the intent of the Office of the Inspector General or Medicare. In fact, Stark II rules apply here. Please join us in closing this loophole that will ensure that our constituents and our patients retain the highest quality of medical care available. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Any questions for the doctor?
I do.
Hang on 1 second. I do want to mention that Representative Coghill is in the audience. Representative Coghill, there's an empty seat up here if you'd like to come forward. Okay, thank you. Okay, Representative Gardner.
Just a point of clarification, Dr. Rosen, when you have a patient who comes to you on an emergency basis because their original surgeon is not available to them and you treat them in your clinic, you're paid for that separately, correct?
That may be true. I mean, sometimes it's a fight, but we typically are paid for that service. But it can be a battle sometimes with the insurance company.
Okay, so it would be something that the insurance company would be responsible for?
It may well fall into that category, certainly. If it's an elective procedure and if it's been paid via cash transaction, then it can become very sticky to try to collect from the patient or from the surgeon because, now you are in this arena that we're talking about. You know, the patient expects to be seen by their surgeon. They're no longer seen by the surgeon because the surgeon doesn't live in the state or is not available. And then, you know, it can become very dicey in that circumstance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you. Okay.
Dr. Bradford.
Yes.
Go ahead. Give us your name and affiliation, please.
My name is Cynthia Bradford, and I'm with the American Academy of Ophthalmology. I'm Secretary for State Affairs.
Go ahead and give us your testimony.
I'm Professor of Ophthalmology at OU Medical School, the Department of Ophthalmology, and I help teach residents eye surgery, cataract surgery. Today I'm representing the American Academy of Ophthalmology, who has a membership of about 27,000. House Bill 151 addresses a problem unique to surgical eye care, and I would like to agree with Dr. Rosen. He did a wonderful job in describing the issue. It's an issue in Alaska, but this issue is also occurring in other states, in my state, for example. And we're not as rural as Alaska, but unfortunately, co-management has become abusive. Instead of trying to deliver patient care, you get into a situation in which co-management is used for financial reward and not in the patient's best interest. And as I mentioned earlier, ocular care and surgery is one of the few places where non-physicians are inappropriately given postoperative care on sometimes a routine basis. As Dr. Rosen described, this arrangement was set up for special situations for patients. But as they've said, this has become abused and not used for the situations it was set up for. This is good health policy, and I support House Bill 151, and I appreciate your interest in the issue. And I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone ready to have a question at this point. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Boyd Walker.
Yes.
State your name and affiliation.
My name is Boyd Walker. I'm an optometrist here in Homer, Alaska.
Go ahead and give us your testimony.
Well, my position on this bill is an opposition, largely because I don't feel it's in the public interest. I've read the sponsor statement by Representative Tom Anderson, and it seems to me that he's been given some misleading information, which unfortunately he's providing to you as factual. Both Dr. Rosen and Representative Anderson have alluded to the idea of cataract mills and that patients are being referred by an optometrist to a surgeon for a co-management fee. And I can tell you unequivocally that this arrangement does not exist in this state, and I would challenge them to present evidence to the contrary. Obviously, I would find this personally unethical and for both the surgeon and the referring optometrist if it did occur, and certainly it's a two-way street. That situation couldn't exist unless the ophthalmologist were involved with it as well. So it seems as if this is not just an optometric management problem. There does exist in Anchorage a surgical center, which is the thinly veiled subject of this bill. And this center has established a reputation for quality patient care and surgery. And many optometrists in the state refer to this clinic, not for a co-management fee as purported by the supporters of this bill, but rather because optometrists know that their patients will be given the best quality care available. And by far the most outrageous assertion in Representative Anderson's statement is that optometrists are not qualified by training or experience to handle any serious complications resulting from cataract surgery. I have been co-managing patients in this state for close to 20 years, and many of these patients were co-managed with surgeons who apparently support this bill, including Dr. Rosen, whom I highly respect. They apparently had no concerns about my ability to either manage or identify the need to return that patient to them for surgical intervention for a postoperative complication. Co-management has been effectively regulated in Alaska and all other states for decades by the guidelines established by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Rosen states that this legislation would have no fiscal impact to consumers or to healthcare costs, where obviously the cost of the patient will be significantly greater if a patient has to travel to receive postoperative care for a surgeon that he could have received locally from an optometrist. Summary, this bill in no way improves the quality or safety of eye care for surgical eye patients in the state of Alaska. In fact, this bill is an ill-conceived attempt to limit competition and the freedom of choice of patients seeking eye surgery in our state. Proponents of this bill have attempted to demean the optometric management of post-surgical patients, citing that optometrists are non-medical. Alaska state law does entitle properly credentialed optometrists to diagnose and treat ocular conditions, despite Dr. Rosen's claim to the contrary. Practically all post-surgical patients will return home one day post-operatively, and home in Alaska may be a long distance from the surgeon. So being able to access a local optometrist for diagnosis and treatment of post-surgical complications in many cases saves the patient expensive and possibly unnecessary travel. Due to the diverse geography of our state and the location of eye surgeons and the larger population centers, optometrists who are located in remote areas of our state are very important in assuring that patients have direct access to care. This bill would restrict that access, in my opinion, would be a great disservice to Alaska residents. Please do not approve this unnecessary legislation. Thank you.
Boyd, I have a question. In your opinion, how long should the surgeon hang around to make sure there aren't any complications?
Well, I think that depends upon the surgeon, and the surgeon should certainly be able to judge that. I guess, again, a lot of what's brought out in this bill seems to imply that the optometrist is dictating to the surgeon when that patient will be returned to him. I believe that the surgeon should have every right to determine how long, as an individual, he wants to keep that patient under his or her control. However, to state as a law that all surgeons have to keep all patients for a certain length of time certainly does not appear to be good medicine to me.
So you're not advocating any certain amount of time?
No, not in the least. I really don't feel that that is the optometrist's job. The surgeon is the one who's responsible for that patient. The surgeon should have confidence in the optometrist doing the co-management, or he should not be participating with that optometrist to begin with. And I think it has to be something where individuals have trust and respect for one another's abilities so that they can properly treat those patients.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? All right, that's all. Is there anyone else online that would like to testify? Okay, then we'll go to the people in the room that would like to testify. Michael Bennett. Would you come forward? Go ahead.
Introduce myself as well.
Introduce yourself and then your affiliation, and then you can go ahead and testify.
I'm Dr. Mike Bennett. I'm an optometrist here in Juneau. I've been here for 6 years, been practicing optometrist for 22 years, long time. And I also would, and my affiliation is I'm president-elect of the Alaska Optometric Physicians Association. I also would like to speak in opposition to House Bill 151. I would like to, I'm sure I'll repeat a couple things that Boyd said and maybe like to expound a little bit more. The practice of having optometrists and ophthalmologists work together as a team to care for surgical patients is what co-management is all about in optometry and ophthalmology. It is certainly not unique to that. I think we are all aware of circumstances where people have had other types of surgeries or oral surgeries and returned to their general dentist or their internist or other family practitioner for some level of follow-up care following those procedures. So it is not exclusive, certainly, to eye care. Most of these surgical procedures that we're referring to were diagnosed by the optometrist. Optometrists outnumber ophthalmologists in this state somewhere between 4 and 5 to 1 and are present in most communities of the state, whereas ophthalmology is centered mostly in Anchorage and Fairbanks, Juneau, I believe Homer, but there's not widespread at all. So the optometrists are the ones that are doing most of the diagnosis of these things, determining the need for the surgery, referring to the appropriate surgical specialist, and preparing the patient for the procedure and giving them a rundown on what they're doing. So it's not like we're unfamiliar with surgical eye care. We're diagnosing the vast majority of the surgical conditions in the first place. This has been codified by Medicare since 1980 and been ruled on more than once by the Office of the Inspector General federally. It is very well spelled out when it is appropriate. Essentially, it was looked at again in 1999, I believe it was, by the Office of the Inspector General, and they issued some guidelines for it, saying specifically that it is not to be a foregone conclusion that the surgeon will return the patient for follow-up care to the referring practitioner, and that it needs to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. And they also stipulated that the three conditions should be that the services be medically necessary to the patient, that the referral back be at a clinically appropriate time as judged by the surgeon, and that the services performed be commensurate with the amount of the fee split. Post-operative care does not result in an additional fee to the patient when it is split between the surgeon and the referring practitioner. There is a portion of the surgical fee designated for the post-operative care. That's divided by 90 days, and the fee is then split by however many days it is being handled by the surgeon versus the other practitioner.
Does the insurance company pay the person that took over, or does the original doctor?
Yeah, the surgeon will, when they, and I'm not a billing specialist, but when the surgeon bills for the procedure, they utilize a modifying code at the end of the procedure code to indicate that the post-operative services are going to be split, and give a date, and then if I were to bill for the post-operative care, my portion of that post-operative care, we would also use a modifying code as well.
Can I ask you this? What part of your of all that you do, I don't know how many people fly into Juneau. I doubt it, if the number would be very high, but. So I mean, how often does that happen to give me an idea?
That I do post-operative care with patients? I see somebody that's post-operative for one procedure or another almost every day, not quite every day probably.
Okay, and is that...
And it depends on... Yeah, and there's a lot of different surgical procedures that take place. Some of those are specialty procedures. Glaucoma procedures, for instance, are not going to be done in Juneau. A lot of people choose to... leave Juneau. A lot of folks, for some reason, love to go to Seattle and have medical care. Feel more comfortable there. So we work with surgeons, a variety of surgeons in a variety of places.
So most of your follow-up is when people have been to Seattle and come back. It's not when somebody comes
here. Seattle or Anchorage, yeah.
Okay, so it's not when somebody, a surgeon comes here, does the surgery, and then leaves.
No, we don't have any surgeons that come to Juneau from outside this.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner.
And in follow-up for that, when you have patients who have had surgical procedures done in Juneau and they come back here or Anchorage, how long do they usually wait before they can come back to Juneau?
Well, that depends. There's a wide variety of medical surgical procedures, and I wanted to give you an example. I work with a highly specialized glaucoma specialist in Seattle quite frequently who also does cataract surgery occasionally. The surgeon will generally have people return to Juneau the day after their outpatient cataract surgery procedure, and we would be responsible for their, they're in Juneau, we would be responsible for their care from that first day forward. The surgeon with certain types of glaucoma surgery that are much more complicated and much more prone to complications and that frequently require adjustments and intervention by the surgeon, that same surgeon will have that patient stay in Seattle for 2 to 3 weeks. I mean, that is part of the deal before he'll even perform surgery on them, that they're going to stay there for that. So the notion that you can attach some sort of a time frame that's appropriate for all eye surgeries, it's not workable. That truly needs to be in the judgment of the surgeon. That is not a judgment that I or, to my knowledge, other optometrists are trying to make for the surgeon. And it's, I think I would avoid a surgeon who would let that be dictated to them. The surgeon is ultimately responsible for that patient's outcome for the full 90-day post-operative period. and needs to either be available to the patient or the patient needs to be prepared to travel back to the surgeon if there is an issue that arises in that 90 days, if there's some recurring surgical intervention that needs to be done. So it's not that surgeons should be responsible for 1 day or 5 days. They're responsible for the full 90-day postoperative period, and no different than I feel that a surgeon has to earn my trust by having high-quality outcomes and highly skilled technically. I feel I have to earn the surgeon's trust by performing quality postoperative care with their patients, and that they have to be, because you know I'm making the referral to them for the surgery. I want a quality outcome for my patient. They're making the referral back to me for postoperative care, and they want quality postoperative services delivered. So it's a trust and respect relationship both ways.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll continue.
So I think it's already been pretty amply covered that, you know, in Juneau or Anchorage, that optometric postoperative care is convenient for the patient and I think beneficial for the patient. We are usually the practitioner that they've been seeing for years and know well and are very familiar with their eyes and conditions, as opposed to a surgeon who, even should they follow them for weeks afterwards, didn't meet the patient typically until the day of surgery or the day before. So it's convenient and nice in urban areas, but I think it's pretty obvious that in rural areas of the state that it's imperative. If we have a five-day postoperative period where it's a misdemeanor for an optometrist to see their patient to render care, and the patient leaves Anchorage and flies back to Dillingham or wherever they reside the day after surgery, you got a gap there where, you know, of course, I'm sure the optometrist would provide the care if necessary, but it would be nice if it were legal to do so. So I think that five-day period for people who live in rural areas is certainly unworkable. Inconvenient in urban areas and unworkable in rural areas. Again, it's been, you know, this has been very effectively regulated federally. It's very well spelled out what is appropriate. As was mentioned earlier, if there are surgeons who are routinely engaging in inappropriate patient care, I think that's something that ought to be looked at by their state medical board. And no other state has ever seen fit to expand upon any of the federal regulations regarding eye surgical co-management, or to my knowledge, any other type of surgical co-management. This would be certainly new ground being broken if we were to embark upon it here. So in summary, this legislation would limit the normal scope of practice of optometrists who have been doing this for many, many years successfully. I should point out there have been studies that have looked at this. Millions of patients have been surgically co-managed by optometrists over the last 25 years, and studies looking at thousands of postoperative outcomes have never been able to show any difference in quality of outcomes in patients who have been surgically co-managed by an optometrist or that have been followed by the original surgeon. I think that you would have seen a statistic there if there were the effect that's being proposed. And it would certainly make this care more difficult to access and more expensive, not from a fee standpoint, but certainly more expensive from a travel standpoint for our patients. So I hope you'd agree that 151 is anti-competitive, unnecessary, and not in the best interest of our patients.
Representative Seaton?
Yes. I'd like to just get a little more detail on your practice here, if you're seeing someone on a co-management kind of basis, basically every day. How do you see this bill impacting just the people here in Juneau?
For those patients who have gone out of town for surgical care, for whatever reason, either because it's more advanced or just that they choose to, it's certainly going to negatively impact them, because they would have a gap. They would either be forced to stay in the community where the surgery was performed, or they would have come back to Juneau, which they typically do the day afterward, and I would be in an awkward legal position for rendering care as necessary to those patients. I'm not clear exactly how this bill would affect co-management relationships with a patient who had surgery out of the state of Alaska. I'm in the state of Alaska. I don't know if I'm still barred from rendering care for 5 days or not.
Okay, and I
follow up.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that at some point in time, we'd like to get that that question there answered as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Eric Coulter.
Hello, thanks for letting me testify on HB 151. My name is Eric Coulter. I'm an ophthalmologist, a medical doctor, and I'm here to talk in favor of HB 151. I work at the Alaska LASIK Center in Anchorage. I have been in Anchorage as a board-certified surgeon and on staff at Providence and Regional Hospitals. I'm gonna bring this towards me a little bit. For the last 5 years. I agree with Doctors Walker and Bennett in the sense that co-management has existed for a long time and is actually originally developed as a result of ophthalmologic requirements in certain communities, and that it takes place very successfully in many many venues. I also agree with Dr. Carl Rosen, the ophthalmologist who testified earlier, that it has potentials for abuse, which reek of collusion when referrals are made for monetary or revenue stream considerations. But I think what I disagree with is that this is less of an ophthalmologic versus optometric battle than it is more of a inter-ophthalmologic effort to set certain standards for all surgeons practicing in the state of Alaska. There are surgeons that live in the community of Anchorage, for example, of which I'm a part, which share call through Providence and Regional Hospitals to deliver care during weekends and after hours, and we share these hours throughout the year. Currently, there are six of us that cover this, and often we are covering the whole state because complex cases are referred to us on an emergent basis. We feel that the standard of care would require that all surgeons that would like to be a part of the community and on staff at the hospitals also share in that call, and certainly that if we are unable to take call or unable to see our own post-operative patients, that we are able to release our patient to a peer who is also an ophthalmologist, board certified and able to do surgery. It's our feeling that as the surgeon himself or herself is best prepared to identify potential complications in the immediate post-operative period. And I think in ways that I do not agree with Dr. Walker and Bennett is that this would somehow limit their ability to care for patients, especially here in Juneau. There are two ophthalmologists here who are board certified and work currently in the community, who I'm sure they refer to for emergent cases. The fact is that nothing in the bill would restrict an optometrist from seeing their patients, especially in situations where it is a hardship as deemed by the patient to be able to see the original surgeon. So there should be no restriction in the flow of patients from their surgeon to the optometrist. They're not barred, for example, from providing care to the patient postoperatively during the first 5 days. Our requirement simply is that surgeons that are doing surgery remain available or can transfer the responsibility for postoperative care to another surgeon. And unfortunately, in the community of Anchorage, there are situations in which some surgeons are operating, leaving immediately, leaving all post-operative care in the first moments after surgery to non-medically licensed professionals that, with all of their skill and training, in our opinion, are less capable of identifying potential complications in a manner that the surgeon who performed the procedure would be. We certainly have data through the American Academy of Ophthalmology to provide you that would indicate surgeons really, especially the surgeon that performed the original case, are in the best position to identify early post-op complications. The original reason 120 hours was placed there is that during the first 5 days you have potentials for infections, post-operative complications usually arise within 5 days. I might suggest 48 hours is where most catastrophic types of post-operative complications might occur, and that the ethical standard we'd like to uphold in the state of Alaska is that the surgeon that performed those procedures are available for at least a couple days after they operate on someone. I don't think that's unreasonable. Also, I had made a couple notes. Both optometrists alluded to the fact that it's the surgeon that should be allowed, not legislated, into evaluating when a surgeon or a patient can be released. And I agree with that. However, the American Academy of Ophthalmology has made it clear that ophthalmologists should be available for at least 5 days postoperatively to care for their patients, should be available, should not leave that burden to a community of other ophthalmologists who had no association with the patient. I don't feel that's in the best interest of the patient. Malpractice insurers, for example, require that you remain available to the patient or that you pass that obligation on to another surgeon of equal competence for a period of days after surgery. And so in most communities where ophthalmologists are part of that community, that surgeon will either be available himself or will pass that responsibility on to a peer. A few other things. Co-management is one of the optometrists, I think it was Dr. Walker, alluded to no paid co-management going on at one point and then 20 years of co-management going on after that that he's been involved with. And co-management is good. This bill does not limit access to optometric care. It provides for people that feel that they are in the bush or somewhere else where an optometrist is available and the ophthalmologist is not, and that's fine. I think the important feature is that the patient be told that their follow-up care does not involve direct contact with the surgeon that did their surgery, that it's going to be an optometrist that cannot intervene, and that they would have to be referred back to the surgeon that performed the procedure. So it is true that this bill was introduced in Florida and Missouri and came within one vote of passing in Florida, and that the mandates through the American Academy of Ophthalmology and the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgeons have put through a joint policy that are essentially recommendations, but there's no ability to enforce those recommendations. And Alaska, being fairly far away from the lower 48, is often seen, in my opinion, as perhaps a place that in the past has not met standards of care. I would suggest that Anchorage and the larger communities of Alaska have met and do meet the standards of medical care in all ophthalmologic specialties. We do not necessarily need to rely on outside professionals to render appropriate or standard of care medical procedures. And if those individuals wish to come and practice in the state, that's fine as long as they're willing to be here and take their share of call and take the burden of community care upon their shoulders like the rest of us do. So for those reasons, I support HB 151. I see it as an advantage to the patients of Alaska. I think it ensures that a surgeon is available for them for 48 hours, and I urge your consideration for a favorable vote on it. Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. You gave us a copy of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, their standards and recommendations, and you've indicated that they don't have any enforcement capability for these standards. Is that accurate?
Correct. That's not an enforceable.
enforcement.
An entity that enforces its policies.
Do you know what proportion of ophthalmologists are members of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, or is there a competing professional organization also?
Well, it would be conjecture on my part, but from meetings and reviews with peers, it's very clear that I would imagine in excess of 90% of board-certified ophthalmologists are members of the American Academy of Ophthalmology.
Okay. Do you happen to know if the particular individuals maybe who come to Anchorage and have the co-management practices that you find objectionable, are they also members of this American Academy of Ophthalmology?
I'm unaware of the answer to that.
Thank you.
It is a recommendation from the body, and most of us abide by that. Certainly no legal obligation to. And keep in mind, this is not about one individual. This is about the entire medical profession, and I think has less to do with optometry. I really don't see how it's going to affect them in their co-management relationships or access to care for the patients. It's about ensuring that a standard is met in a community that perhaps used to benefit from traveling surgeons or surgeons that come in and out of town. But at this state, in the community's development, we don't think it's meeting the standard of care.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Yes. We were talking about a little about Juneau. Under this provisions of this bill, would you, if you perform surgery in Anchorage on someone, you would no longer, as let's say an optometrist, optometrist from Juneau referred someone to you for ophthalmology surgery, you would not be able to refer back to them that person who was their normal caretaker. You would have to use someone else, one of the other two ophthalmologists in Juneau as the caretaker?
I would simply need to be available to that patient myself personally for 48 hours. That patient can always do what that patient desires to do. And if that patient would like to go back to Juneau and be seen by their optometrist, that's fine. I think the spirit of the Reformation is simply that I am available to that patient. That I take care of their post-op care. I can certainly not force a patient to see me for their post-op care. But if, for example, they come in, it's a hardship for them to get to Anchorage. They're here. They've had, let's say, cataract or LASIK surgery, for example. They're seeing their optometrist for post-op care. Things look fine. Great. If things don't look fine for some reason, then the patient is welcome to come back to see me, meaning I'm available, and it was my intent to see them for the next 48 hours at least. But there should be, my understanding of the bill at least, is that there should be no limit to optometric post-op care for that patient. Is that
follow-up? So you're saying that the optometrist could do it for free or for other fees, but it couldn't be related to care that they contract with you as far as the surgeon goes, as far as the full management.
Correct, sir. They would always be able to charge what they desired for their post-op care. Often I will send patients back to communities where it is not very easy for them to get back in touch with me. And we simply copy medical records and send them with them, instructing that, always without compromise, we see them at least 24 hours after the procedure, the surgeon, i.e. me. But often the patients live out in the outback or in the bush or someplace where perhaps it is easier to see an optometrist, and that's fine. I think the point is if they change their mind midway or they have a complication, that I'm available for them during that post-op period. In other words, if I operate, get up and go to Hawaii, and they try to reach me and nobody's available, there better be somebody in my stead that can care for that patient. That's what's required as being a staff member of the hospitals. It's required by malpractice insurers, and I think it should be required by all surgeons.
So,
I don't think I'm answering your question based on your
Well, I'm just trying to figure it out. I mean, that it sounds like they can provide post-operative care as long as they don't have an agreement with you to provide postoperative care as part of the fee distribution under your surgery. So you're saying that they wouldn't be guilty of a Class A misdemeanor by doing postoperative care as long as it is not under a co-management agreement with
as
you?
As long as it's outlined, it doesn't outlaw co-management. My understanding of it is simply that the co-management is laid out up front. Basically, you would like...
I can explain it.
I guess there's some confusion.
I think somehow it's being construed as a bill that would really limit access to care, and that's not the intent. The intent is to not limit access to the surgeon that performed the surgery.
Can I touch?
At least that's my perspective on it.
Representative Seaton, I think what's happening here is that if an ophthalmologist who has gone to medical school and has an MD performs a surgery, certainly it's less expensive to them if 48 hours afterward they don't have to be available and can be working on other things, if you will, and can sort of pass off that responsibility to an optometrist, and they can form these co-management agreements and sort of say, we're going to build in a lower cost, because my cost as a medical doctor per hour is more expensive than it is for an optometrist. And so what's happening is a lot of surgeons are doing that, just that. The consumer is in the position of sort of being unaware of that. You go in to get LASIK surgery, and those aren't questions that you know to ask. Are you in a co-management agreement with an optometrist, or will I be able to see you 48 hours or after the surgery? And so my understanding from everybody I've talked to, this not just this year but in years past, is that you kind of end up with this unlevel playing field, but it's the consumer who loses. That if you end up getting surgery by a medical doctor, and unbeknownst to you, as a cost-shifting mechanism, your eye doctor has agreed that your eye doctor won't be available to care for you postoperatively, but an optometrist will, and something really bad happens, it might be you that loses. And so it's just what you said. I think you summarized it really well, actually, in your question, that what it says is you can't, as part of the co-management agreement, you can't shift that responsibility for post-operative care off onto somebody who doesn't have the same training. That does not mean that if the patient chose on their own volition to go and see an optometrist, maybe because they don't have an ophthalmologist in their community or because they feel like it, that they couldn't do that. I mean, so the patient's choice is preserved in there. But, and it doesn't mean that a medical doctor couldn't contract with an optometrist to provide care at some other point in the process. But it's that immediate period following the surgery.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I just want to follow up, because as I read page 2, starting line 10 or line 12, it says the agreement may only be entered into and restricts co-managing agreement to when there's this distance criteria, right, when the surgeon's personal travel or illness is there,
right,
so that the co-management agreements are not fully available to the ophthalmologist and an optometrist. They can only be entered into under these circumstances that are outlined on page 2. So, anyway, maybe...
For example, if the patient feels it's a hardship to return and would prefer to see the optometrist here in Juneau, that would be fine by my understanding then.
And also, if I understand it right, there's nothing in there that's saying after, say, 48 hours, that the surgeon is feeling pretty confident that things are going well, and he would say, you know, the optometrist can go ahead and follow up. There's nothing in this bill that says that can't happen, right?
No.
Yeah.
Right.
That's my understanding of that. The other, I think the gist of this is to try to get the best quality patient care. And if we weren't seeing abuses of that process, this wouldn't be here.
Right.
We're all plenty busy in Anchorage. And there's really not a different itinerary here. We're simply interested in ensuring that surgeons who want to operate within our state feel obligated to remain for a few days so that a disproportionate of postoperative complications doesn't lie in the laps of six ophthalmologists taking call for the state. And as well-trained as an optometrist may be, if they identify a problem that requires surgical intervention, they're not going to be doing it. They're not on staff at the hospitals. They do not have a medical license. They will not be doing that procedure. I will be, or Griff Steiner will be, or Ed Crouch will be, or Carl Rosen will be. But they won't be. And so we don't mind that. It's a part and parcel of what we do. We do it because we like it. But when a disproportionate number of people are being directed to a single surgeon who comes and leaves without remaining postoperatively, we feel those patients are being put at risk unfairly, meaning we have no problem with competition between surgeons. There's a lot of dark shadows that start to get read into this, but they're really non-existent. The fact is, we want people to have choices, and we certainly don't care where optometrists refer people, and they should have full ability to refer wherever they bloody well please. But it should be well known to the patient what they are getting into. And if they want to send a patient with a cataract to Dr. A, as long as they know Dr. A's coming in and out and the only time they're going to see him is when they're laying on the table, fine. But we think that should be spelled out and made clear. Mm-hmm. And that we also feel that Dr. A should be obligated to remain available to see their patients for a minimum period of time. And so really, in my mind, it's more of an ophthalmologic self-regulation initiative than it is some sort of divisive tool to be used between ophthalmologists and optometrists, both of which have coexisted wonderfully for years. My father's an ophthalmologist in Santa Barbara, California, who's helped train and lots of optometrists in California, and I've worked with them, I've employed them. I mean, in general, we're friends, although you don't seem to get most of that side here in these proceedings. But I think there's really less of an argument than might be apparent.
I would think, as the ophthalmologist, that you would feel better, too, if you were following up with a patient that you at least knew a little bit about it before the patient came into the emergency room under an emergency situation. And I don't think there's anything in this bill that would preclude if a doctor wanted to go back to where Seattle, say, he could ask you to, at least for the next 24 hours, watch that patient so he could go back. I mean, I think that
absolutely
sounds like...
if that doctor comes and wants to make an agreement. You know, it's the same at the hospitals, regional Providence and Anchorage. If we operate there, part of being on staff requires that we identify the other surgeon that will take over for our care if we are inaccessible for whatever reasons. And what we've discovered is that often there are situations where surgeons have come and left without appropriate peers that have been identified to replace their responsibilities when they're gone. And, you know, perhaps you feel like, gee whiz, you got to regulate how long a surgeon has to be there. I thought surgeons were ethical and wonderful people. Well, they are, and it's true, and the optometrists would agree, I think, that the vast majority of ophthalmologic procedures, most of them go great. The technology is wonderful. Most people that are doing the surgeries are very experienced, and almost all the time they go well. But when they don't, you know, it's the folks on call that get called. Mm-hmm. And we'd like to have there be a seamless transfer of care between the physicians. And so that's part of what this does. I think the other issue that the optometrist raised was, well, don't we want the best quality of care, and isn't limiting access to care going to reduce quality of care? My argument would be, isn't the best quality of care when your operative surgeon remains available to you for a few days during the most likely time, if you're going to get a complication, that your surgeon's available? And my argument would be yes. You don't need a pile of research papers to realize that, ideally, if you got a surgery and you're recovering, it'd be great if your surgeon sat at the end of your bed on a stool watching you. That would be great. Realistically, does that happen? No. Does co-management exist? Yes. But there are outlines for its appropriate use. This is not designed to eliminate co-management. It's an important revenue stream for optometrists. They like to know that they can send folks to wherever they feel comfortable. But if there is a co-management system in place, that surgeon should be available, and that patient should be made well aware that co-management policy is being utilized.
Okay. I've got Representative Seaton has a follow-up, and then Gardner, and then Anderson.
Yeah, I had a question because somebody, you know, there had been 24 hours and 48 hours been thrown around, but I believe the bill, as I read it, is 120 hours. Is that
correct?
Okay.
Originally phrased because 5 days. Keep in mind, I didn't write this bill. I'm in support of it. This is through the American Academy of Ophthalmology and the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgeons. And 120 hours seems like, where did you get that? Well, 5 days. That's the typical date after which you are unlikely to get postoperative infection or complications. Drops have often dropped away for many minor refractive surgeries, for example. Cataract surgeries, people can remain on drops longer. But that was the standard developed at those two ophthalmologic entities. We have since felt that, well, if 120 seems excessive for some reason, 48 would be the bare minimum that would really be required in our minds for the most likely time period during which a catastrophic post-op complication might occur. And we feel that it would be important for a surgeon to remain available during that time or transfer to a peer that would be available for that person if they were heading out of town.
And just to follow up then, do you have some data for us or anything showing that 48 hours is the time?
The ideal time frame?
Or that
I can certainly gather that information from the Academy and the Society of Refractive Surgeons and present it to you if you prefer.
Thanks.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. If current procedures put patient health at risk, shouldn't this be something that the medical board addresses rather than the legislature?
You may be correct. I can't comment knowledgeably on the extent of the Alaska Medical Board's ability to regulate how long a surgeon stays in state after they operate. I think that is something I would have to defer to a more knowledgeable entity.
Follow up, are they basically charged with sort of identifying and clarifying good medical practice?
I think in part they're certainly responsible for that. For surgeons coming into the state, they have to meet rigorous standards to be able to be given a license to practice medicine here. Certainly they are effective at removing poor surgeons or surgeons with excess complications or mass public outcry, these sorts of things. The extent of their power, so to speak, to regulate co-management is another issue. And in my mind, I don't know of any board except on a case-by-case basis, if there was a patient that perhaps did poorly as a result of a co-management case, perhaps the medical board would take interest. But I'm going to speak outside my area of expertise, and I am going to exhaust my knowledge shortly on that subject. So.
Thank you.
Hey, Representative.
Thanks, Madam Chair. First of all, thank you for your testimony. I think you shed light more than the others because you went into detail, I think, point by point, Doctor, and I appreciate that. To answer Representative Gardner's question, I think that the Alaska Medical Association is the professional regulatory body, but I think the ophthalmologists came to me, I don't think I know, because they wanted the foundation, the codification by statute. So, and so often we see associations and professions come to us first as the legislative body, and then kind of by extrapolation, their professional regulatory body handles it on a second level. But I think the strategy is important, and then there would be no miscommunication. I think the doctor brought up some good points, and one pleasant perk is that even he can't leave. I think the optometrist talked about for the 48 hours. Optometrist talked about and testified to the fact that, hey, this is preventing competition. It's been testified kind of in refutation to that, wait a minute, if anything, there's fairness and it's a fair playing field as it is, and we're looking at the patient first. But the fringe benefit is that when you operate, you have to stay for 2 days as well, or you have to get a fellow ophthalmologist, whether it be in Anchorage or wherever you're operating, to do that. So I think the benefit as well is that we keep our doctors here, and it mandates that they stay. Representative Seaton's correct that it currently says 120 hours, and the reason the testimony was 48 hours was because before the meeting we talked about amending, and I plan to make an amendment. I think 5 days is unreasonable, and I know that you took that from the federal language, but I think 2 days is fine. And if anything, your testimony, I prefaced my staff's presentation by, I don't want to offend either side, but you've reinforced why I've sponsored the bill. So I appreciate that, because I think it does come down to the patient. And it's not a slight on the optometrist. And if anything, you've complimented him with accolades throughout, talking about not only your father and your own employment of those, but your partnership with and the need for them, especially in rural Alaska. I think he's addressed aspects of the studies on co-management, that it's not anti-competition, and the expense to the patient is obligated to the patient. If they go to Anchorage and want to come back after 3 hours of surgery and have an optometrist handle their care, then that's their right, but that would, I would assume, be advised against. So I don't think it limits that. If anything, it encourages their health. Madam Chair, I would say, unless there's more people to testify, I'll get to amendments after the committee members have their questions answered.
Representative McGuire.
Yeah, well, I was just kind of coming up with a scenario in my mind, but to try to help it seem easier. I mean, I think when you go to get surgery, well, first of all, to do surgery in the state of Alaska, you have to have an MD. I mean, you have to have a medical license, and so we've got a board that tracks that and makes sure that the surgeons that come into our state are competent. But it isn't just the surgery for which we're licensing physicians. It's the surgery, the aftercare, the troubleshooting, being there at that critical moment when there might be a drug complication that nobody envisioned and your life is on the line in a way it wasn't in the surgical room. So what we're talking about is the ability, in effect, and you understand it's dollars, to sort of transfer that medical license, to transfer that responsibility that you have taken through your medical license and through the fee that you collected from your patient to somebody else who does not have, again, a very qualified, great person, nothing derogatory, but who doesn't have the residency, the experience in troubleshooting, the additional higher sciences degrees. And there's a high incentive, if you think about it, for some of these individuals that live in other states, traveling for a day. It's a lot less expensive if you don't have to stick around. And if you can transfer that, there's a great incentive for the optometrist because you can make money doing it. And they're not bad people for wanting to make money. But the problem, I think, as I see it, is that I don't think doing it through the medical board is enough. I think it takes, when it affects consumers in such a broad way, I think it takes the legislature to spell it out in the statutes. And again, I just see this from the point of view of a patient. Many patients are not as educated or not as aware of the options and the choices that they might have in other places. And they see a price tag associated with a particular procedure, and they jump on it. And then when things, as Dr. Coulter said, things go well, that's great. But when things don't go well, and it's your eyes, the consequences are very severe. And so that's the other thing. And then just one note I want to put on the record, too, that has always bothered me, and there's probably no way around it, but I think individuals that have MDs ought to have, and most do have, that responsibility of sharing a call duty. And that's a service to our community. They don't make any money for it, and frankly, they put their behinds on the line from a liability perspective because they're in the ER when everything's breaking loose, and they're there to pick up the pieces, as Representative Wilson knows better than any of us here on this committee. And that's another thing that I think is an opportunity for us to, again, also reemphasize the value of our Alaska surgeons who are part of our communities, who do share in the call schedules, who are there to pick up the pieces when God forbid something happens to any of us. And I don't think there's a way you can require outside individuals to do that, but it's just something that's always troubled me. So those are just my comments.
Well, and I also, the reason this bill has been referred to HESS is because we have responsibility as legislators in this committee to make sure that we are watching out for the our constituents across this state, and that we are making sure that we're looking at what's best for them, you know, and what their best interest is. And I kind of want to go back to all across the state we have first responders, and there's people that always go out in with ambulances and take care of the patient until they get to the emergency room. And whether it's an emergency room in a hospital or whether it's a clinic somewhere out in the bush, there's always one rule that you always have to be very careful of, that when you transfer that patient to be taken care of by somebody else, that there's always a rule that you always make sure that you are never transferring that patient to someone at a lower level of care, that same level of care is there in case, you know, you want to make sure that whether you're, if you're an EMT3, you don't want to transfer that to someone that if something happened, that they wouldn't be able to handle anything that would come up. And I think that's kind of what we're looking at right here. We're looking at to make sure that patient is in good hands, that if there was something that came up, that person that's taking care of them in the critical time that is needed, that they will be able to handle what comes up. And I think that's what we're looking at here, to make sure that the patient is the one that we're concerned about. And so I think we have to look at it in that way. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I guess I do have some problems with legislatively coming in and saying that 48 hours is right. I mean, what we are saying is the ophthalmologists, whether they're in Anchorage or Seattle, that are sending people home in 24 hours, that are not keeping that person there for that 48 hours, is doing bad medical practice. Because now we are going to legislate that we know in this HESS committee what good medical practice is. And that's going to be 48 hours of immediate availability to the original surgeon or another ophthalmologist within his practice. And we are establishing that and saying that the care that is being given currently in Seattle, all around the country, I think, and in Anchorage, and send people back in after 24 hours for some eye surgeries. Because we don't have any distinction here between very acute, very difficult eye surgeries and the more normal kind of thing. We're saying every eye surgery is the same, and 48 hours is this time that I think that we're going to say 48. Right now we're saying 5 days.
I want to know an eye surgery that's not acute.
Well, all I can say is that there are a lot of patients that go home after 24 hours or that go back after 24 hours that apparently, and if you want to say that we know on HESS committee from testimony we've heard or something else that every eye surgery should stay with the ophthalmologist for 48 hours, that's a call you can make. I just don't think we have the data to tell us that, especially when we've had testimony that there are numerous patients that are going to Seattle. Presumably they're seeing good ophthalmologists and are being sent back to Juneau after 24 hours. So we've got to, in that case, say that those surgeons are not performing good medical practice if we are labeling it as bad medical practice. And so I'm just uncomfortable without any data pulling that number out of the hat.
Can I respond to Mr. C?
Go ahead.
Okay. I think in response to that, I would say that certainly if a patient wants to go out of state, that's their choice. And we're talking about surgery that takes place in Alaska. There's nothing that says that a patient leaving 24 hours later is doing himself or the surgeon is doing the patient a bad thing. I think what we're suggesting is that if that patient goes back to where he was operated upon, that surgeon is still there. In other words, that patient is not let go back to Juneau. Now the patient goes back to Seattle with a complication and can't find a surgeon because that surgeon is missing. So my suggestion is that when you suggest that that surgeon and patient be handcuffed together for 48 hours, I think you're misunderstanding the spirit of the bill, which is not that we have to be handcuffed. That's still good medical judgment. It's simply that the surgeon is available to treat the patient.
Or he assigns to you or some other medical doctor.
Or a peer of mine. And so in that sense, 48-hour requirement is not strange or bizarre. And also, I might say that you are implementing, not inventing, the 48-hour issue. And in fact, it's 120 hours is what the norm was said. And as I indicated earlier, I can get you the paperwork on why that's considered a normal post-op period. As alluded to earlier, the paid post-op period can extend for 3 months. And there's nothing about what we're suggesting that would prevent optometry from being a part of that. But the acute phase for 120 hours is considered not just by the people in this room, but it's considered by the largest bodies of organized, medically licensed ophthalmologic surgeons in the United States. It's not a fragmentary number. So to implement a number like that, 48 would be a minimum, and I think 120 might sound excessive to some, but if you were to go by the national recommendations put out by those two bodies, then 120 hours would be it.
I'm going to ask a question here, and you can remain there. Boyd Walker, are you still online?
Yes.
Okay, from Homer. And I have a question because I want to make sure. I think Mr. Walker said that people came down there to do surgery, but is there any ophthalmologists in Homer? I want to make sure.
You're at Satanga.
Okay, so there is someone.
There's an ophthalmologist in Homer named Garrett Satanga, board-certified surgeon, does many surgeries.
And that is correct.
He and I, Peter Canova.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that we're not putting into something in place that would be impossible in some areas. We're talking about Anchorage basically because it doesn't happen in Juneau, but because it happens in Homer, is there anywhere else across the state that it happens that we want to make sure that everything is covered and that we're not absolutely letting somebody be left out in this bill? So I just wanted to make sure that Mr. Walker, would you like to comment?
Well, yes, I would, not necessarily directly at that, but it appears from what Dr. Coulter is saying that he's asking you to support this legislation so that they can control their surgeons' actions. And yet I fail to see what the significance of having the word optometry or co-management in that bill does to facilitate that. If, in fact, the surgeons feel that it's a requirement that a surgeon maintain a patient under their control or they be available for them for 48 hours or 60 hours or whatever it is, as I told you, I'm not supporting limiting that in any way. But there's a lot more to this bill. It's not just a simple statement that thou shalt not do eye surgery and leave the patient before 120 hours. It has another couple pages that go along with it, which most certainly do affect the access of care by a patient to an optometric physician for follow-up care for surgery. And I understand fully what Dr. Coulter and Dr. Rosner are saying regarding on-call and them following up other surgeons' surgeries, but that's not an issue that involves optometry or co-management or other like arrangements that have been in place for years. And my question to all of you is, why then does this bill encompass co-management and optometric care when we're trying to limit surgeons in what they do?
It's the money.
Well, he didn't answer your question, but he went. That was his chance to respond in general.
Representative Anderson, would you like to speak?
I would. Just very briefly, thank you, Madam Chair, because I know we've taken up an hour and a half of the committee's time on this legislation. I appreciate, again, Dr. Coulter's responses. And I would just say that he, as a medical doctor, and Dr. Rosen and Dr. Bradford, who is a officer of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, have all stated that 2 days would be sufficient. So, I mean, we often find, just to Representative Seaton, that you can't have substantive statistics, you know, I would have to give you a packet this big of all the legislation I'm doing each time for those hypothetical questions. Is 48 hours sufficient? But they've testified that in terms of their care, post-operative surgery, the complications arise most often within 2 to 5 days, hence the 5 days at the federal level that was recommended. But because we feel that may be arduous or too difficult for these surgeons coming into town, you're saying 2 days would be the minimum, hence the amendment I plan to propose after we stop public testimony.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify in this bill?
No takers.
I would love to.
Public testimony?
Yeah. You know what? There are some questions. I think it's very obvious that we have some questions here that we're not quite sure of. You've got some answers that you're going to look at, kind of do a little bit of research and bring back to us. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to hold the bill until next time. Next time we'll deal with this bill. I'm not trying to kill the bill by any means, but I think if we had the answers to those questions, everybody would feel a little bit more comfortable about dealing with it, and we can and finish it. We'll bring it up. It'll be the first thing on the agenda the next time we meet. And so I'm going to hold the bill till we get just a little bit more answers there, and I think we'll all feel a little more comfortable with it. So having said that, we're just going to lay it aside and bring it up the next time, first thing next time. Okay? Thank you. And we are going to go now to House Bill 16. And House Bill 16 is the school funds related to boarding schools. And okay. Representative Chenault's Chief of Staff, Representative Coghill's Chief of Staff is here to, we've got Representative Coghill, are you going to come forward and tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for letting me come before you with House Bill 16. I'm doing like you. I'm shifting gears here. So, House Bill 16 has one major theme in it, and that is how to help some of the boarding schools in Alaska that I think that are doing a very good job. We have right now in Alaska, if somebody wants to go to a boarding school, if in their school district they don't have access to the high school education, probably, I think the ADM is the proper number, the proper way of saying it, then they can actually be paid by the state to go to another school. Hmm. And that actually has happening in Alaska right now as we speak. So this is a little bit of an expansion of that by saying that under certain circumstances, we will give a stipend to some students if they go outside of their district or even go in within their district to a boarding school. So that's one of the things. I have a sensitivity to how that might affect other schools, so I tried to put some sideboards into this bill. First off, it has to be a school that is a the boarding school the stipend would go to, they would have to be operating on a 180-day school system. So that's one way of doing it. The other way we've put sideboards on it is if we have a student that's going to a school and by their absence that would kick them out from under the number floor that says that that school quits being funded, we would hold them harmless. And there's a range, and I would ask the department to give you the discussion on that range because I've heard it several times, but I don't know that I can explain it as well as the department does. But as I understand it, the bottom part of that floor is 10, but the funding floor of that is from 20 and below. So the time that it would be most effective, most actually detrimental to a school district is if it was that last student, that number 10. And we put in here that it would hold them harmless. The other sideboard that I put on this is to do it in a five-year time frame, because I didn't want to create a stipend that would go to boarding schools just to start a bunch of boarding schools, because we're still trying to figure out how they all work. And quite frankly, there's one in Galena, there's one in Nenana, and there's one in Bethel that would be affected by this, and they're all three very, very different programs. So I think this gives us a chance to evaluate. But I can tell you, all three of them have people that want to go to them, to the point where I know for sure that both Galena and Nenana have wait lists. I'm not too sure about Bethel. So, and once again, Bethel is a little different setup than Nenana, as is Galena. So, very different. So it would have those schools that are now presently doing it, and just for the information of the committee, we have a state-run boarding school that is another totally different operation, entirely different. Whereas this, just these school districts are taking the student dollar count and using them for the schooling. I think at Mount Inchcombe, not only do they do that, but there's a different cost factor involved in it. I don't understand the whole thing about Edgecombe, so once again, I would lean on the department for that. So I'll tell you how I was personally convinced of this. I was born and raised in Nenana, so there's no doubt that the one in Nenana would probably get my attention most, but Galena also. I was working in my hometown, Nenana, one summer when some of these students decided to stay with one of the native groups and do a core job with them. And I worked shoulder to shoulder with them for just about 3 weeks. And they're telling me, unsolicited, what that meant to them really lit a fire in my heart. Mm-hmm. So every year you see me in front of this committee, once again, bringing it up, and a lot of people say, well, yeah, it's Nenana, it's his hometown, but it was really those kids that kind of lit the fire in my heart. So, and they didn't know me. I don't even think they knew I was a legislator. So it really did start the journey that I find here again. This House passed this very similar issue last year, I think 38-0, and we just got bogged up in the Senate. The questions in the Senate revolved around how one of the boarding schools operated, and I think we answered that question fairly well. There are questions, though, and I think they need to be answered. For example, will these schools take some of the best and brightest from some of the smaller districts and bring them into the boarding schools? And from the information that I've been able to glean, I would say no. And I would just ask those who do have that argument to come and let's compare the name lists in the towns and have that discussion, because from all the lists that I've been able to tell, just in my unprofessional way, I haven't been able to see that it's done that. It has saved the state some money. It's debatable how much. And the way it saves money is, you might take a student from a district where, because of the low count of students, the dollar per student is very high in that district. And they would come then to Nenana, where the student dollar reimbursement is a little lower based on the geographical differential and all those things. Add that up, and those that come to Nenana and Galena especially, and I'm not too sure about Bethel, I'd have to ask about that, show that there probably is some savings there. But I'm not doing this for the savings. I think this is just one avenue where education really does excel. And the reason it excels, in my view, is because the two that I know fairly well, Galena and Nenana, there is an interest from the parents, the children, and the community. And anytime you have an expectation that all three of them get together, you're going to have students excelling, which they are doing. Many of them are coming from very tough circumstances, so this gives them an opportunity to change their lifestyle a little bit, and then excel. The reason I put the sideboards of saying no more is because we need to find out if it works that good, how then should it work? But these communities, Galena and Nenana especially, and Bethel, I think, have put in much of their own what I call industry, sweat equity, capital within, and been very creative. I think Galena's been probably most creative because they had an air base there and were able to make use of some facilities, somehow got a hold of Ted Stevens' attention and managed to get some interesting grants and access to equipment, and they're doing some VOTEC things that are absolutely fascinating. And so the youngsters coming from all over Alaska, quite frankly, are able to go into a VOTEC. Now, Nenana, probably a little less VOTEC and more college prep. And I can tell you by the numbers that I have here, from the 03-04 graduating class, it looks like of the 15, I'd have to sit down, it looks like seven of them went to the university. And so obviously it's good college prep stuff. I think the reason I think it's good college prep is because there's a socialization issue. There's being away from home and being in an academic atmosphere. The one in Nenana I know better. They have kind of a study hall thing that happens every evening. So there's a real focus on that. And yet they do have physical activities. They actually have a very good volleyball team that has come out of that because of these youngsters coming from all over the state. So there's a lot of kind of positive things that are happening. But the college prep probably from Nenana, the VOTEC probably from Galena. And I think Bethel has a little different focus. I haven't had much discussion, and I'm a little jealous. This week we have some people actually going out to Bethel. So I'm going to probably put a bug in here and ask them to make sure some of those people contact me. But the bill as it is allows for a stipend. That means the department can determine a stipend that they would get on a monthly basis, plus the one trip to and from that school. So it is an addition, but remember, it's a stipend. We're not talking about carrying the full load of that care. So the parents are still going to have to put in. The school district's still going to have to make some things available, and the state now can participate through a stipend. So that's the benefit of these boarding schools, the purpose of the bill. Without going into language, I'm open to questions.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you very much. Representative Coghill, I love this bill.
Thank you.
I think it supports school choices. It gives rural kids other opportunities than their own small villages. I had the great pleasure of meeting with Jim Smith, the superintendent of Galena, and he's very enthusiastic, full of ideas and plans, and the VOTEC program, I think, meets a need in this state that should be expanded in a lot of areas, and the work they're doing there is just great, very exciting. But he also pointed out that the school provides a refuge for some children whose villages or whose home life are less than ideal, and they can go to school and be in a comfortable environment that's sort of socially comfortable for them without having to be really in an out-of-home placement. And it occurs to me that if not the best and the brightest, maybe the most motivated kids would be going there. And even if that does adversely impact their homeschools, would you not say that it's sort of unfair to these kids to impede that, even if their homeschools are affected?
You caught my mind wandering, so I don't know that I totally got your question exactly right, so I probably better have you restate it, because I was thinking about another part that I was going to respond to you on, and I wouldn't want to misspeak.
Okay. If it's not the best and the brightest kids who are looking to go to a boarding school, but maybe the most motivated and those whose parents are helping them do that, I could see how that would possibly adversely impact their home schools to lose them to the boarding schools. But I wouldn't want to stand in their way. I would still applaud them and encourage it,
even if there is a certain cost to their own schools. Would you agree with that?
I know we've struggled with the No Child Left Behind, but I don't struggle with the words No Child Left Behind. And the answer is yes. I think we should allow a student to excel to the best of their ability. And that means that we are probably going to have to change some things in some locales. You said the word homeschooling, and that set me off on a total different mindset. So that's probably why I had to have you restate it. But the home districts definitely they're scratching their heads just like everybody else in Alaska. How can they get the best education for their students? As are the parents. But once you see a student hunger for education, that'll turn you on. So, and that's what happened to me. It's not my purpose here, I can tell you, to hurt local home districts. No. In the Special Committee on Education in this very room today, they had a demonstration from the First Alaskans on a whole range of issues. And you can tell that we're all struggling with how do we work our way out of kind of economic doldrums, huge social problems, and educational needs all at once. I think this is just one of many good avenues.
Mm-hmm. Representative Seaton was next, and then Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify, when you're saying per pupil stipend, you're not talking in the normal way when we talk about a stipend where the student receives some money. You're talking about reimbursable cost amount to a district for cost per student. Is that
right.
correct?
It would be, yes, it would be to the district reimbursement or a stipend for boarding of that student.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Number one, I applaud and support this concept. I think it's really great. Number two, it brings on an ache in my heart that we can't fully support other programs in the state that desperately need our investment and our support, and these children truly need to have us being right behind them. But we've got all these other kids throughout the state that in many cases don't have a chance because we're not there for them. Thank you.
You know, Madam Chair, just may I respond to that? Because that's a question that I struggle with as well. I had to put the sideboards on it because, first of all, we need to see how well it's working. And that is going to be a benefit to fewer students than I would personally like. And I agree with that. However, we also have a huge debate going on within rural communities on how they're going to answer some of their educational needs there, too. And I think we need to work on all fronts. So that's why I put the sideboards on this. It wasn't to just limit it to a few good chosen students. It's unfortunate that each one of these is going to have a wait list. However, but that also will ratchet up probably the desire and the will to change things in those districts. Mm-hmm. So I'm game.
I'm Representative Coghill. I'm going to remind you that you said that. that you really truly want to see what can be done for those other schools in the other areas. That
didn't always
help
say that
them.
Was money, Madam Chair.
I am concerned about the stipend. How much money are we talking about? I mean, you said a stipend, and maybe Eddie Jeans could answer that, because I need to know how much money is that.
I could certainly have Eddie Jeans come and speak to it. He probably has those numbers fairly well in there. But I think in the packet I gave you, did I give you this list that shows the different schools? In there it says an annual airfare, estimated round trip, and yearly cost, but it also shows a monthly stipend there, and it ranges from $577 to $472, and that would be a monthly stipend. And this is as of, I don't have the date on here, but I believe that that's this year's. I got packet. Obviously, this is a three-year-old packet, so I think I got the right one. But somewhere around $500 a month is the stipend. And I can tell you the boarding school costs are much more than $500 a month.
I know how much the numbers are for Mount Edgecombe. And I know the benefits the kids get in Mount Edgecombe. I mean, it's when I go, I teach in all my schools in my district. I do a state government class. And so I go to several, I visit 17 different classes and do that. And it's amazing to me. These kids are on top of it. I mean, they know so much, and they're so prepared. You can just tell that they're excited, they're happy to be there, and they're prepared in ways that actually kids in other schools aren't. And I can see the difference when I go in, when I ask them different questions. Not just one or two kids will raise their hand, but I mean all of them. Every one of them will raise their hand with the answer, and that's just, that doesn't happen in any of the other schools I go to. So that there is a difference, and so it's a wonderful opportunity for these kids. And any other questions?
Do you want a motion?
I do.
Madam Chair, I move that we move House Bill 16 out of this committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
And having no heard no objections, the motion passed. So
thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you. All right, let's do House Bill 20. And House Bill 20 is Representative Seaton has education funding, and I'll let you just present your case.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. House Bill 20 is early funding of education, and what we've done in this bill is in the last legislature, there was House Bill 19. It was also looking at early funding. We've made several changes. First of all, this bill basically requires a separate appropriation budget or separation appropriation bill for the expenses for primary and secondary schools. The original bill that was introduced has been modified somewhat so that the governor is required by the fourth day of the legislative session to submit the education budget, and the legislature shall finish that by March 5th and submit it back to the governor. We amended the bill from the original, which just included the foundation formula, so now it may include all the other appropriations, including pupil trans, special schools, those things, but it may not include appropriations for other things, such as capital projects. The reason for doing this is to separate out those contentious issues that are to each individual school district, and we've seen it in the past where there are some capital issues put into the educational budget, and then it's a fight between the House and the Senate, and the education funding doesn't get done until later. We have the main purpose of this bill is to stop the disruptive practice of having the districts go in and lay off many teachers. You know, they send out pink slips on March 15th, March 16th, which is a statutory deadline currently for tenured teachers, and they generally just send out the pink slips to all the non-tenured teachers as well, and then wait until the budget's passed so they'll know whether they have money to hire their teachers and then rehire teachers, and we lose lots of good teachers, and it's morally disrupting disrupts the morale within most of the school districts. So this is an attempt to get a process in place. There's no dollar amounts attached to this, but it establishes a process by which we'll go forward. And we've had support from numerous school boards across the state, and I could give you some of those. I think in the packet you have some of the letters from school boards and teachers and the unions, both NEA and the AFT, supporting getting rid of the problem that we encounter with late funding of education. And so time's late, so I'll just quit there and answer any questions.
I think you did a good job. We kind of, this is something that the schools have been concerned about for a long time, and it will make a difference for those pink slips. So anybody have any questions? on the committee. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify? Representative Gardner?
If we're ready, I'd like to move House Bill 20 from committee with any individual recommendations accompanying fiscal note. I guess there isn't one, is there?
Is there fiscal note?
Yes.
There is. Sorry. Okay, with accompanying fiscal note.
Okay.
I just want to object just to make a statement on the record. I'm willing to support my colleague and allow the bill to go out today. I don't know what my ultimate disposition will be. I want to take some time to look at it. It's a great idea. It's all the things that we talk about wanting to do. And, you know, getting schools money early, making it predictable, making it early so that they don't go through those kinds of pink slip layoff type situations. That being said, our work here in Juneau is vast, and there are a lot of well-deserving programs and parts of the budget that deserve equal focus, and at different points in time more focus depending on the crises. For example, if we had some kind of public health epidemic, we might be looking at the HES budget in kind of an urgent way that we didn't before. We have the supplemental that can kind of address fire suppression and some of those, but those are some examples of places where you have real emergencies. My only concern about this particular bill is that it sets up a lot of hard and fast rules and dates for the legislature and for the governor. And while that sounds like a great idea, from year to year, it's difficult to know what types of issues we'll be facing and what time period we'll have to respond to those. So I support the concept, I support you, and I'll let it go forward. I just want to have an opportunity to think a little bit more about how it would work and play out, and just wanted to put those thoughts out there for my colleagues to consider as well.
Representative
Eve? Yeah, and Madam Chair, I appreciate that very much. I mean, it's we've modified some things in the Education Committee and all, but we have had testimony from administration and on down, you know, in levels that aren't political, that submission of the education budget by the fourth day of the legislative session is very doable. And the only other date that we have in here is March 5th, in which we would complete the education budget. And, you know, the goal here has been to separate education out from the other issues, such as capital projects and those other things that generally are what get things balled up. And this in no way means that we couldn't go forward with supplemental of any type for public health or anything else. So anyway, yeah, and I'd sure be willing to talk with anybody about the bill.
And just in response, sure, through the chair, I completely agree. That's why we set up the school fund this year, unprecedented move that we did in the legislature to sort of recognize that it is a special need that we face every year. It's one of the highest parts of our budget and one of the most important parts. We also set a goal at the outset of this year. We received the governor's budget and the governor's numbers right about the fourth week. And we set a goal of, let's see, well, it was March 1st and then it was March 15th. And so here we are, it's March 8th. Mm-hmm. So it sounds great. I'm just simply pointing out that how things play out in reality is often more complex. So I support you. I support the goal.
Would you like to withdraw your objection?
Yes, I would. I would withdraw my objection, Madam Chair.
Okay. Having no objection before us now, the motion passed. So this bill has passed, and we will close this meeting. However, I just want everybody to remember that the next meeting, then, the very first thing up on the agenda will be that bill, Representative Anderson's bill.
So, and that's a week from today, right?
Yes, it's a week from today. So having said that, we adjourn this meeting.